What I would like to do is to speak for about 45 minutes. I've gotten permission with Dr. Paulsons and David and Sean because of the slightly later start, which is appropriate on a Saturday morning. I will speak till 10, then take questions for 15 minutes, and then we'll have our break, a sort of a 15-minute break. Is that right, David? Yes. And then Dr. Paulson will give his concluding address. I'm going to begin, by saying a prayer, which is now located in the Episcopal Prayer Book as the collect for the fifth Sunday in Lent. O Almighty God, who alone canst order the unruly wills and affections of sinful men and women, grant unto thy people that they may love the thing which thou commandest and desire that which thou dost promise, that so among the sundry and manifold changes of the world, our hearts may surely there be fixed, where true joys are to be found. Through Jesus Christ, our Lord, who liveth and reigneth with thee and the Holy Spirit, one God, now and forever. Amen. The title of this short talk is Grace in Literature, Ab-Reaction in Art. And again, a very warm welcome. A number of folk have come today who have not been with us earlier in the conference, and I welcome you, especially if this is your first session in this remarkable once-off. This is what a conference is supposed to be like. Notice how much space has been given for people to get to know one another. There's not been too much input. When I say there's been plenty of input, but not too much, so we could process it in relationship to each other. This is an ideal conference in my experience. As a matter of fact, speaking in terms of the dynamic, I've never been part of a better conference than today. No, because, I mean, I've been to bazillions and you have too, but there weren't people just getting up to hear themselves speak and hit and run. Did you notice that Dr. Martin was with us last night? Dr. Paulson, Dr. Martin is here now. Oh my heavens! There you go. And you notice that, Dr. Paulson has been unbelievably convivial till the late hour. This is the sign of a movement, rather than an ideology or a group or a process. And this has really been a fantastic experience for me and Mary. Now, the thing about grace in literature and ab-reaction in art is that Mockingbird is trying to do, in addition to its core theological affirmations about grace in relation to law, spirit in relationship to this world, I believe that Mockingbird is also trying to build bridges to the secular world outside us through the use of media, popular culture, movies, drama, music, YouTube, everything you can possibly imagine. Now, why are we doing that? First, because we have to cross over. We have to make contact with the world. And the vast majority of Christian presentations that you hear are simply preaching to the choir, quote, end of quote, or exhausting the few people who are still going out of guilt, or simply manifesting a mammoth ignorance functionally in terms of what's really going on around us. So in an age such as ours, you have to cross over in relationship to movies, music, and television, not to mention 100 other formats. Now, it's not just, however, because we have to keep afloat, but we cross over because we have to be able to communicate on non-rational terms, because people actually do not hear or experience things really rationally. It's a fundamental error of Christians who claim that you can reach people through their heads. It's simply not true. I mean, a lot of people think it, and a lot of people claim it with tremendous, almost virulent intensity. But it's not true. I'm not reached through my head, I'm reached through my heart and my feeling. And so if we're going to communicate with anybody, let alone how God communicates to us, it has to be non-rational, because our lives are inward. Remember, the reality of life has nothing to do with what's happening. It has nothing to do with schedules and things that you do, and, oh, I have to do this today. The reality of life is about inwardness. It's about, does he love me? Can I count on her? I can't. why am I so extraordinarily nervous in the presence of him? Why does she give me such an aversion that I can't even be in the same room with her? Why does this situation cause me to get physically ill or to find myself having all sorts of odd fantasies in my head? So it is a fact, and I have to demonstrate this, but I do to many people, that communication is non-rational. We might say it's emotional fundamentally. And so our interest in media has to do with the fact that things you see, images and things you hear, music especially, dramatic parables of real life situations and inner conflicts are how people hear things. The great example in literature, there are many, but one of the great ones is the play in Hamlet, in which a message needs to be communicated to the murderous stepfather of Hamlet. But there's no way that a frontal assault can possibly make contact. So Shakespeare gives Hamlet the conceit of putting on a play dramatizing a murder. And because it's distanced from rational or direct assault, which is highly defensible, the king gets it. And this is the reason Jesus spoke in parables. He spoke about he didn't try to connect with people rationally because he knew that they would not hear. So he connected with people non-rationally. And the only debates that the Lord had rationally, he lost. In all his debates with the Pharisees, did not result in the conversion of the Pharisees. Not one. That's not his mistake, but they're there to show us that rational encounter, it's like email communication. You never convince anyone because all you're doing is taking turns talking. There's no real relationship. So if you think you will ever convince anyone of anything on an email posting thread, you simply don't know yourself. Because I'd nothing wrong with it, and we do it. And it's interesting. But you will never, have you noticed that no one ever says, you know, I totally agree with you now. I take back post 17. Deleted at author's request. Now, so the first point was that we want to reach a culture which is connected non-rationally to its life. Secondly, We want to cross over and reach the people who are walking around and at the Strand bookstore or in the park across the way or at Baruch College. And the other thing I want to say about this media dimension is it will never work if you don't like the stuff. In other words, you have to like it. If you're trying to do it sort of deliberately as a tool to reach someone else, you're condescending and you're forcing and it's artificial. And a lot of the evangelism that we were exposed to in the Church of England in the early 70s was sort of people who were trying to do it because they thought they should, but they really weren't in love with the movies. So if you don't actually have a feeling and a heart for whatever it is you like, whatever kind, whether it's movies, YouTube communications, documentaries, strange advertisements, literature of a certain kind, television shows, whatever it is, Brian Wilson, Axel, if you don't like that stuff, it will come across as being hollow and constrained. But fortunately, most of you, especially the men, are into this kind of stuff. That's how you survive. It's mostly a male phenomenon. It has to do with fantasy, a tremendous need to have fantasy in light of the psycholibidinal male life. This is a fact. I'm not to anyone here who knows anything about video games understands this or has any contact with that world. But there are women who have many likes too. They will be different and they bring whatever theirs are. And the question you have to ask yourself is, what do I really enjoy about popular culture or the world that's coming at me all the time in the media? And then go with that. That's what you want to do. With you, it'll be different from him, be different from me. But everybody here has a few things. Everybody has something that they like. It may be fashion, you know, that you can connect with people. But you're dealing with a non-rational thing that you like. And then you communicate with non-rational people. Now, in our world, as Christians, we're going to have a particular gravitation towards things that give us the ability to abreact our mourning. Because a fundamental human need is the ability to mourn loss. M-O-U-R-N. And a fundamental part of what people are liking or dealing with, they watch a movie that helps them with their anxiety. Or they watch a movie that helps them to mourn a loss that is too powerful for words. And therefore you cry in a movie. You rent a video and you cry because it touches a primeval core loss in you in the same way that Hamlet's play touched a very, very deep guilt in Claudius. When you come across a movie or a play or a piece of literature that not only gets you in contact with the loss of that children all experience as part of growing up, and it's a work of compassionate mercy on mourners and deep compassionate understanding of you in your sorrows of life or your angers for that matter, then you've really got something special. You not only are communicating non-rationally with yourself, but there's healing. For example, the movie Red Beard, 1967, Akira Kurosawa, Japanese movie. It's 3 hours of Japanese language. And it's about a young doctor who knows nothing about life at all. And he is helped by an older man, played by Toshiro Mifune, to understand the nature of life through a graceful as opposed to a judgmental or critical relationship. And if you take this movie home, you can get it from any place around here. It's on the Criterion Collection. I defy anyone here not to be reduced massively to hysterical sobbing at least 4 times during the movie, even if you're a stony heart. Because what Kurosawa does over 3 hours, he gets into the fundamental lovelessness and aspiration to be loved of young people in the context of a benign father, and a man comes to himself, and then he proceeds to spread what he has learned about mercy to concentric circles of people in a community in which everyone is saved. Now, the movie is not explicitly Christian. Kurosawa was extremely reluctant ever to talk about Christianity, although he had it in his background, which he never wanted anyone to know. His word would be, oh, my movies are Dostoevskian. That was his way of saying, my movies are Christian. But this movie, Redbeard, touches mourning, it touches mercy, it touches hope, it touches bewilderedness, it touches old age, it touches long-lost love, it touches adultery, it touches failed pregnancies, it touches everything, including the death of a child. And yet you come out of it soaring like a kite, because the power of the abreaction, which is a word for the feelings coming out and being able to be presented and therefore reacted to through a parable, the movie Redbeard, makes you feel just unbelievably unnihilistic. Now, the first part of my little talk is to make those three points. We do it because we have to do it to get through to a world. We do it because communication is fundamentally heart and non-rational. Three, we do it because we like it. I mean, I don't know if you noticed, Guns N' Roses was playing all the time last night in that chapel. It was a little discreet, but there it was. And because David Zoll has a thing about Axl Rose, but it's very worthy. If you actually learn about Axl Rose's life, that is a template for the human condition. Now, I'd now like to switch and give you some examples. I'd like to go through some examples, about five of them, of how this actually works. And then at the end of going through the examples, I'd like to say one limit that there is on non-rational communication of grace. There is one limit on this kind of communication, and that's new. So this talk is new. I've never given this talk before, and I don't know what's going to come out of my mouth in any event. But I'm going to give some examples of some very interesting media literature things that connect in this kind of a way, and then I'm going to end with a slight constraint on this kind of communication. So will you turn to your handout? And we're just going to go through a few of these. I'm going to point out a few things. And what I used to do with my students at Trinity, our students together, was to point out from an unusual movie like Abel Ferrara's The Addiction or some unusual music that you could see things as a Christian that were helpful to you, helped you to abreact certain feelings you might have, and also gave you the eye. I wanted to give students the eye, so when you look around you, you see that actually everybody is drowning out there. Every movie, every play, it's actually all a cry for help. Almost everything that's out there is some form of a cry for help. Misconceived. I loved it when President Obama the other day, someone asked him a question at the press conference, and Obama said, well, I disagree with the question. I mean, you're not framing the question properly. And a lot of the things that people do out there are not framed properly because people aren't really in touch with what's really going on. But all of this material, the graphic art, paintings, this stuff, it's a cry for help. Now, I'm going to read from the journals of Jack Kerouac and explain something about that. And I'm going to put this over one of the candles. Kerouac's an intriguing character, and it's a sub-interest of mine. And I won't talk about him as a person, but he was kind of an inspired muse through whom God spoke tremendous insights, notwithstanding his own unparalleled sinful lifestyle in his own, using his own words. And this little passage from a journal he wrote during the time that he was a student at Columbia, and after he dropped out of Columbia uptown to kind of go around the world as a Coast Guard mariner, is a absolutely extraordinary totally out of left field description of original sin slash pride slash ego slash identity. And he has connotes an understanding of what makes people into self-asserting machines in a very compassionate manner, because he includes his own mother, who was the closest person in his life. And I'll just read. It's from Windblown World, which are the journals, his early journals. I had a picture of the human intensity of men. This is walking around New York. This is everybody. Me and you, but it's everybody who's walking around fruitlessly. Everyone who's in the suburbs, they're driving around fruitlessly. In here, they're walking fruitlessly, bitterly, resentfully, with no real meaning in the intense anxiety of the rapid road to nowhere. And he writes this. I had a picture of the human intensity of men as being represented by some little agitating organism on the forefront of the brain, even on the brow. And that being the ever-present palpitation, the brain's heart of pride. Pride to humility, back and forth in the intenser neurotic sense. Pride to humility, back and forth. Can you just see that little thing beating away like a heart, but more mental than a heart, wilder, more, quote, intelligent? The source of all our troubles, too. But now I see, says of this moment, being a philosopher, and turn to the action and mystery and details and human horror and, quote, beauty of that little thing. Shall I give it a name? It is just above the eyes somehow. And incidentally, it is not the thing that kills us. It is our very life itself, our being, our humanity, our pride. It is all things in a way. It is our nervous being. But again, I cease being a namer of unnameables, at least not so much now as before. My new novel in mind, On the Road, will begin among these new precepts, thoughts, discoveries. Even a calm woman like my mother has that wild pride palpitating on her brow. You see, I've discovered the thing. He's discovered human identity in its sinful, demanding, voracious, insatiable quality. And he says, I'll be wiser now, although that's a prideful statement. And then he says, through all these things, last sort of 5-6 lines, it was possible for me to realize the following fragmentary things about myself, since truth can only be the truth of myself, which I see inside me, and cannot be universalized and vaguely generalized into truth for all men, whose insides I, of course, cannot see, trusting, therefore, that the truth in me may be the same in them. Then I realized these true thoughts about myself. Now, you can take that home and think about it. But what Kerouac understood was, if he understood himself, he would understand other people. Let me say that the key to ministry is knowing yourself. It's an old, old idea, and it's an old truth. But the key to preaching is knowing yourself. What Kerouac said, that what the preacher has to do, as well as the poet, is he or she has to dig deeply enough in yourself to get to that substratum of yourself that is the same as the substratum in everybody else. He believed that if you dig to the substratum in yourself, you are then in voice-to-voice contact with the substratum of your listeners, because deep down we're all the same underneath. Remember, we don't believe that male and female are fundamentally different. We believe that's a secondary difference. We don't believe that the races or ethnicities are fundamental differences, significant differences, even more than tertiary. But fundamentally, we believe that everyone is in the same degree of mourning and suffering, i.e. 100%. So if you can get to yourself, you'll be able to preach. The reason most people don't succeed in preaching is that they're not in contact with themselves. That's just a maxim, and I lay it out there. But if a person is in contact with herself or himself at that level, then it's like a dog whistle. When I preach, I'm blowing a dog whistle. And I'm hoping to get you and her and him, because your adversity has taken away the levels of normal defense. And you, in fact, may be at that substratum, which is Paul. So Paul speaks to Tina, speaks to Mary at a level in which we are all the same. Remember what T.S. Eliot said when the psychiatrist, the sort of Christ priest figure in the cocktail party, says this to the nurse? The psychiatrist says, "All cases are unique, yet oddly similar." And this is why it's possible for us to really preach and connect. So that's what the Journal of Jack Kerouac is about. Now, turn the page. And in 1930, the American writer Thornton Wilder published a series of about 25 what he called 3-minute plays. And these were plays meant to be performed in 3 minutes. And he wrote them while he was a prep school master at the Lawrenceville School in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. And these 3-minute plays were controversial because they all deal with Christian themes specifically. And when you go to Wilder, who had had a very great sorrow in his life early on, although no one has ever discovered what it was. I'm in contact with his lead biographer, and she said, for Wilder to have written with the perceptiveness that he did at age 28, there's only one possible explanation, that he had had a great reversal in his life. But no one has ever been able to find out exactly what it was, although there are many theories. But in this play, which he wrote then, called The Angel That Troubled the Waters, take it home, I'm going to read a couple sentences. This is the Pool of Bethesda. That's a place in Maryland. And he is at the Pool of Bethesda, and he fails to be healed. He is not healed. And he is trying to understand why someone else has been healed and he has not. And he has a group of words that the angel speaks to him that are so gospel that this means that you need to go home and read everything that Thornton Wilder ever wrote. Because here is a man who's in touch with his own sorrow, too deep for words. He is a genius poet, and he comes out of the Christian tradition, his uncle being a famous New Testament scholar who is married to Dorothy Martin. Just a joke. But having said it, Dorothy's husband knew this man. But the angel, at the end of the last line of the play, you're on the last page of this? The angel says to the man who is, the newcomer says to the angel, "Oh, in such an hour was I born, and doubly fearful to me is the flaw in my heart. Must I drag my shame, prince and singer, all my days more bowed than my neighbor?" And the angel says to him, "Without your wound, where would your power be? It is your very remorse that makes your low voice tremble into the hearts of men." Now look at that. Your power stems from your wound, Theologia Crucis. It is your remorse that makes your low voice tremble into the hearts of men. That's the dog whistle. If you're in touch with your remorse, if you're in touch with the inward truth in your life, which is basically thwarted, disappointed, unsatisfied, nothing ever is exactly what it should have been, and you're really deeply, awesomely bewildered by what life has brought you at a certain level, it is that, your low dog whistle, that actually allows your communication to tremble into the hearts of men. Notice this, the next line. The very angels themselves cannot persuade the wretched and blundering children on earth, as can one human being broken on the wheels of living. In love's service, only the wounded soldiers can serve. Draw back. Don't be healed. Now, are you out of your mind? I mean, Wilder has caught everything that this conference is about at age 28 in a 3-minute play that three of you can act out right now. Now, let's look, so you can see why one would be drawn to an author, but you have your Thornton Wilders. You have your, what's the guy who just died that everybody's totally focused on now? David Foster Wallace. I mean, he can be your Thornton Wilder because you live now. You know, I'm so yesterday, right? But that play isn't yesterday. Now, let's go a little further. How much land does a man need? What I'm going to do is read a section of a Tolstoy story, and then I'm going to switch to my third and final point. What you find every so often in literature, but very seldom in the church, and I know we seem like we're dissing the church, but the church is a profoundly failed entity. And in many ways, the church shouldn't exist because there's no grounds for it in the ministry of Jesus. There's a movement, there's a body and a group of people in the ministry of Jesus, but the church, as we've come to know it, doesn't really factor at all. And the only things that Jesus ever says about churches are negative. So you have to sometimes, you know, you can find it buried in the Book of Common Prayer, and I mean buried. But to get the real message, you often have to find it outside of the canonical sources, truth to tell. And I'm going to read a brief section of a story called Where Love Is, God Is by Leo Tolstoy. I'm going to comment on it briefly, and then I'm going to make my final point. Tolstoy, because of his own many thorns in the flesh, which are psycholibidinal, remember what the fundamental flaw is in everybody is usually a psychosexual flaw. That's the core issue with people from 2 to 82, is the whole libidinal dimension, whether it's been flustered, satisfied, unrequited, betrayed, blustered, exaggerated, transferred, sublimated, depressed, overwrought, frenzied, neurotically prospering, unneurotically prospering. That's the fundamental core flaw. And if you want to find out what was really going on with Wilder and any of these people and Kerouac and Tolstoy, it's always cherchez la femme. Always look in that dimension. But because of Tolstoy's own enormous problems, he understood the gospel. And in this story called Where Love Is, God Is, in about 5 paragraphs, he gives the gospel in a perfect manner. And I'm just going to read it. It's worth reading the whole 5 paragraphs, and then we'll switch, and I'll stay on schedule. There's a shoemaker who's concerned that he's sick, and he's looking out of a window in his basement house, and he's looking at the passing scene, and he sees a woman pass by and who runs into a little boy. And in this little parable, the entire gospel that Stephen Paulson has been speaking about is expressed. It's towards the middle of page 119 where I have a little bracket. You see it? Martin ate some soup, cleared the table, and sat down to work. As he worked, he kept watching the window, and every time a shadow fell across it, he would immediately look up to see who was passing. Then, an old market woman stopped right in front of his window. She was carrying an apple basket, but appeared to have sold most of her wares as it was almost empty. On one shoulder was a sack of wood shavings, which she had most probably collected at some place where they were building, and was on her way home. The sack was clearly very heavy and was hurting her, so to shift it to her other shoulder, she put it down on the pavement, placed the apple basket on a post, and gave the shavings a shake. Just as she was doing this, a boy in a ragged cap suddenly ran up, grabbed an apple, and tried to run off with it. But the old woman had spotted him, turned round, and grabbed his sleeve. The boy tried to struggle free, but the woman seized him with both hands, knocked his cap off, and caught hold of his hair. The boy screamed, and the woman cursed. Martin did not want to make fast his awl, but threw it down, rushed through the door, and stumbled up the stairs, dropping his spectacles on the way. Out in the street, the woman was cursing away and evidently intended hauling the boy off to the police station. He struggled and protested his innocence. "I never took it," he said. "What are you hitting me for? Let me go." Martin separated them, took the boy by the hand, and said, "Let him go, Grandma. Forgive him, for Christ's sake." I'll forgive him, but not before he's had a taste of some new birch twigs. I'm taking the little devil to the police station." Martin did his best to dissuade her. "Please let him go, Grandma. He won't ever do it again. For Christ's sake, let him go." The old woman released the boy who wanted to run off, but Martin stopped him. "You should ask the old woman to forgive you," he said. "And don't you ever do it again. I saw you take it." The boy burst into tears and begged her to forgive him. "That's the way. Now, here's an apple for you," Martin said, taking an apple from the basket and handing it to the boy. "I'll pay for it, Grandma. Restitution, justice, common sense, forgiveness, and release. Now, the charge of antinomianism. But you'll only spoil little devils like him that way. What he deserves is such a thrashing, he won't be able to sit down for a week." "Oh, Grandma," Martin retorted, "that may be our way, the world's way, but it's not God's way. If the punishment for stealing just one apple is a thorough thrashing, then what should we deserve for our mortal sins?" You know, I feel like Eric Cartman at that point. I want to say it's a vulgarism. What should we, because he's so completely right. The woman did not reply. You see, the argument is unanswerable. But, so Martin told her the parable of the master who excused one of his servants a great debt, and how that servant went out and seized his own debtor by the throat. The old woman listened, and so did the boy. "God has commanded us to forgive, otherwise he will not forgive us. We should forgive everyone, not least thoughtless little boys." The old woman shook her head and sighed. "Well, that's all very well, but children are terribly spoiled these days." Now, this is those of you who are concerned about raising small children and the first and second use of the law, here we come. "Then it's up to the elders to teach them what's right," Martin said. "Yes, I agree," the old woman replied. "I had 7 children once, but now I've only 1 daughter." Aha. She's beginning to understand about herself. She's beginning to realize that this is actually ultimately about herself. She had 7 children once. They're all gone. She only has a daughter. And then the woman told Martin how and where she and her daughter were living and how many grandchildren she had. "As you can see, I'm not very strong," she said, "but I still have to work myself to the bone. I feel so sorry for my grandchildren. Such lovely boys, all of them. Not one is as kind to me as they are. And my Alyushka wouldn't leave me for anyone. Dear mummy," she says, "you're such a dear." And the old woman was quite overcome. This is preaching. She's found herself. She's come to herself with mourning and also belovedness, which is a form of relieved mourning. And she's now in touch with real things. "Well, I suppose," says the woman at this point, "it's because he's so young," looking at the boy, because now she's looking at her own grandson. She's realizing that she is part of the human race, and he is. "May God be with him." She was about to lift her sack onto her shoulders when the boy immediately ran forward to help. Are you out of your mind? This is the pure gospel. The boy runs forward. "Let me carry that for you, Grandma. I'm going your way." The old woman accepted and put the sack on the boy's back. And off they went down the street. The old woman forgot to ask Martin to pay for the apple. She's so completely caught up in the inwardness of a new transferred over a relationship that is now positive, because you know the boy will end up moving in with her, that she doesn't even need justice, quote, justice. And Martin stood there watching and listening to them talking as they went. Now, in that little 5 paragraphs, Leo Tolstoy has summed up the entire gospel, the reactions that we have towards the gospel, the church's Pharisaism against the gospel, and the only way to ever get through to Pharisees, which is to bring them in touch with their own common ground. And as a result, the little boy becomes nice, the woman becomes compassionate, a new family is made. She now has a boy to look after her in her old age. And it is all because of the character of the forgiveness wrought by the visiting angel, Martin. Okay, now I'm going to say when you get home, turn the page, read The Family Reunion by T.S. Eliot, an extraordinary work of psychodynamic Christian reality written in the 1920s. And as you think about your own life in what Dorothy yesterday called the sort of new, the new way, remember that you will all be seen initially like the people at the bottom of the page in the segment of The Family Reunion, where Aunt Agatha says, "In a world of fugitives, the person taking the opposite direction will appear to run away." And that's us. We live in a world of fugitives. I notice that everybody walks too fast. I just can't tell you. I'm constantly walking down Connecticut Avenue with people, and they're all walking so fast. I said, "Where are you going?" "Well, wherever you're going." "You know, we're going to lunch." And I don't understand. "Why are you walking so fast? You're going very quickly to nowhere. What is this fast walking all the time?" People look at me like I'm a nut. Where I live, it's all about career. Here, it's all about self-fulfillment and tattoos and tanning parlors. But whatever it is, I don't know. Usually about money in New York is the old cliche. But notice that in a world of fugitives, if you are the person taking the opposite direction, you will appear to run away. When you get home, read the telescoped short story about loss, grace, mourning, and Christianity by Mark Rutherford called The Sweetness of a Man's Friend. And I've given that to you. It has probably the most unsettling and damaging and moving final paragraph as any short story short of Edith Wharton's Afterword, which has a similar wallop. And at the end, I've given you a tip to go get a really terrible movie with Bob Hope called The Private Navy of Sergeant O'Farrell, which, despite its absurd, dated, ridiculous World War II comedy plot, is an absolute masterpiece of Christian psychodrama in the middle of a Hollywood absurd icon. So you'll know exactly what I mean when you see it. It is the perfect form of pseudo-antinomianism that ends up becoming a work of pure Christian morality. The Private Navy of Sergeant O'Farrell. Okay, I'm now going to finish with one final word, and then we'll have a few minutes for questions. The only thing about all this art and literature and media is that the only constraint about it is that sometimes it lets us do our emotional business in a detached rather than a direct way. In other words, you can be so into movies that you're not really into your wife. Obviously, I'm not speaking about myself. Or you could be so into music that you're really not into your kid, your child, or your friend, or your partner, or your, whoever it is. A lot of men, you know, at the end of a long day are so wiped, they don't want to talk about anything. In the 80s, they just wanted to sit in front and watch, surf channels, you know, till 11 o'clock. They would zone. Now it's other things. But you can find your need for abreaction emotionally at the end of a stressed out time so focused in this kind of repetitive circle of media substitution that you don't actually deal with the person who it's fundamentally about. You know, I'll see a million movies about my mother, but I won't talk to my mother. I mean, they're not really about my mother, but that's really what they're about. You know, Psycho. You know, I mean, that was about me, not my mother. You can see a million dramas about men and women or love relationships, romantic relationships that are very moving without actually connecting with the one person who you are in a romantic relation with or could be. It's a tremendous problem. So the only constraint I would want to say is beware in a kind of humorous and ironic way that you don't find all this substitutive symbolic acting out becomes a real substitute for acting out and has an effect on your intimate life in your marriage or your non-intimate life in your first marriage, or your current relationship with a friend who you really want to talk to, but you're working it out through Dostoevsky. That's very important that you realize that good as all these things are, they are in fact a form of symbolic substitution rather than direct, unmediated encounter. And there's nothing like looking somebody in the eye. Thornton Wilder, in his novel, The Eighth Day, said that whenever you actually look somebody in the eye directly for more than about 10 seconds, you'll either kill them or marry them. Because to actually look somebody directly into the eye quietly is to look into the very deepest part of a person. Now that, of course, is what we want. Okay, I'm finished.
We've got 15 minutes for questions or comments, but mainly questions.
Were you just emailing somebody before making that announcement?
No, I was just checking the time.
Okay. Comments or questions of any kind?
What are you watching on TV these days?
I'm actually, believe it or not, I'm getting a little too highbrow. I've been watching mostly movies. I've been watching Jerry Lewis. I mean, talk about... I don't watch much television. I know everyone does, and I should watch more of it, and I've had my years. But currently I've been watching Jerry Lewis because of his interesting direction and his heart. He just wears his heart on his sleeve. And I've also been immersed in Akira Kurosawa and his movie Rhapsody in August, which was made recently in 1991, has just had Mary and me just sort of not knowing whether we should laugh or cry for the last 4 weeks, Rhapsody in August. So I'm watching a lot of movies. I found that the movie Ikiru, 1953 by Kurosawa, is sort of the entire story of life. And so I keep that under my bed. And I'm when I went to the Strand, I'm into Thomas Carlyle right now because somebody I regard very highly recently said that Thomas Carlyle was the most impressive voice of the 19th century. I'm into whatever, comes along. But it's all in the form, in the desire to abreact my morning. And in the parish, I find the parish ministry is laden with symbolic substitutive actions about nothing. I find that there's a tremendous amount of emotional energy transferred over into utterly symbolic, ridiculous secondary matters that are so awesomely out of proportion to the reality of what's really going on that when I come home, I feel like I'm in a kind of psychodrama all day until I'm able to be in contact with something real, pastoral counseling or preaching. So I do find the parish ministry forces me more and more into some of this stuff. Were you nodding your head, Keith? Good. Okay, I was hoping. There's Joseph Martin, and then there's Mary Haynes.
Joseph, then Mary.
Yes, Paul, I'm always amazed how you can speak to us personally sometimes through your examples, but act like you're not really trying to. And you have, in your examples, I think it's because you talk to us before this is all going on, and you know what we're dealing with, and then you have a way of kind of blowing the dog whistle unintentionally, it seems, but I'm thinking that you really know what you're doing. This is a compliment because in the subtle way that you do, you reach the heart, and I'm thinking you're really good at it.
Keep on, Joseph.
But it's, yeah. I'm trying to get good at it, yeah. Because what I'm thinking you're doing is you understand kind of where people are, having talked to them, but rather than be direct and just say, you know, you're really messed up and you have a weird relationship with your mother or something. You don't do that, but then you do in your own kind of way.
So what's your...
My question is, when you encounter this person in your life that you know is trapped or, you know, doesn't really get it or something, do you... is it a skill that you are learning to reach them, or is it kind of passive? You know what I'm saying? Are we intentional about reaching people in your kind of way?
Yes. Thanks. A very wonderful question, Joseph. Let me answer it on three fronts. You cannot reach people through a direct assault. It's simply, you think you can, but you cannot. It's absolutely impossible to reach. People will say they're listening to you, but the moment you come across is critical. Remember, any unsolicited advice is always taken as criticism. There are no exceptions to that. So what you do is you work through parables. These are all parables. But there are two things I want to major on. First, people say often, well, how much time do you spend on your sermons? And I say 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a week, a year. And as a result, no time. I don't have any notes. I never go into the pulpit with notes. Except sometimes if I'm afraid I might have a TIA or a stroke, that's when I have to have a few words down there. Because if you have a stroke, you do have to have notes. But because I'm thinking about, because I'm in a, life is therapy. Let me just say this to you all. You may not realize it. You may find this a humiliating statement. But until, life is basically therapy. And occasionally you have successful therapy through the healing process of God's grace, the community, a good therapist, and the deep abreacted emotions of life coming out. You then can offer something. You could then offer something to others. But the secret of getting through to people, and I cannot say this strongly enough, is being in contact with yourself. And the clergy that speak in theological aphorisms or religious language, true as it is in many cases, are completely unable to connect with anybody unless they're in contact with themselves. That is a universal fact. So it means that this process I'm talking about is costly. It's a pain in the neck. I hate it because it means I'm having to go into my own inner abscesses and recesses all the time. So, and let me say, that's the material principle of ministry, is being in touch with your own hurts, abreacted through the grace of God and therefore disarmed of their compulsive grip. That's the material. The formal way this works out is illustrations. If you do not have illustrations in your sermons, you will never connect. Now, you will say, well, doesn't the Bible connect of itself? The answer is no. The Bible does not connect of itself. The Bible is meant to be interpreted. It cannot connect. People will say it can connect of itself. And, of course, the Holy Spirit can occasionally do that. But it's like a coal of fire taken to that recess and abscess. The key to a sermon or a talk is an illustration arising out of your own hurt. But it has to be, very often it's in form of a Tolstoy or a movie. So the material principle of communicating the gospel is self-understanding. And it's archaeological. It's archaeological. And it's a pain. And the formal principle of it is the illustration. You can preach a 45-minute expository sermon on Romans 1:17, and if there's not an illustration, you really should go home and just do nothing. So, we don't need to go too long because we have to hear Stephen. Okay, Mary, and then Jason.
I like one-liners, and I heard one a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, just speak real close to the mic.
Okay. I heard one a few weeks ago that I'm carrying with me, and I would like to share it with you. I don't care how much you know. I only want to know how much you care.
Huh. Thank you very much. Wow. Thank you very much, Mary. Bless you. Another thought. That's Jacoba Smith.
Paul, I've been into the Twilight Zone lately and Alfred Hitchcock, but I was wanting to know if you could speak briefly about the Gospel According to Rod Serling.
Well, the Gospel According to Rod Serling is a very interesting question because Rod Serling was a deeply troubled man, like everybody. You know, we say deeply troubled. I mean, Paul Zoll, a deeply troubled man, occasionally preached, you know. he was just a normally troubled man. He came from a Reformed Jewish background in Binghamton, but he married a liberal Protestant woman, so he had to deal in the 50s, because in the 50s everyone went to church in some form of a way. He had to deal with Christianity, and he ran into a very, very good Unitarian minister in Los Gatos, California, or Palos Verdes, who actually had something to say. And so Rod Serling, at his best, is a moralist. He is a moralist who understands that there is tremendous judgment in moral failures that must come out, and we are basically killed by our sins. And so the great Rod Serling scripts, and there are about 25, reveal profound moralism in that way, and about 10 of them have deep Christian implications. And in one of them, which no one knows, it's called The Arrival, and it was in the third season of The Twilight Zone, 1964, Christ appears and brings people forgiveness from their sins, signed Rod Serling. So if you have an interest, because Twilight Zone nuts like myself always say that he must have been on cocaine when he did that one, you know, or it was a sop to Procter and Gamble. But you will find at least 4 Twilight Zone episodes in the original series that specifically bring Jesus Christ into them. And so, yes, Rod Serling was deeply invested in that, but sadly, the church itself let him down in the long run, and he died a very, very deeply confused agnostic. Thank you for that pointed question. Last question.
I just have a general question. Can you speak a little bit about the relationship between Jesus and abreaction art in a way that doesn't talk about theological mumbo jumbo?
Oh, my gosh. I wish Stephen Paulson, that's your job. Well, the great problem we face, this is a big question for us all. The Jesus Christ Christology dimension, in light of the abreaction of our mourning losses and sins, can sound arbitrary. In other words, why him and not just the process of grace and abreaction? And we had one question that asked that yesterday during one of the sessions. What is specific about Jesus that doesn't seem a little arbitrary? If I can watch Red Beard by Dostoevsky in Japanese without Jesus, why do we need Jesus? And that is an enormous issue that I think Christians do need to address. Why is it that you can have parables of grace that are not grace? But I think that are not Christian specifically. Now, actually, Steve said it. We understand Jesus shows us the clearest expression of this of any figure in religion. Therefore, Christianity has a powerful, moving, apparent superiority to all other accounts of a divine figure who might relate to grace. But I thought John Zoll said it brilliantly in a fantastic session yesterday in which we had a very, very deeply felt abreaction in person, in front, unmediated on the part of Kate. Kate Norris's expression of her own experience of this was so unmediated and so undistanced that it was almost the perfect picture of the pastoral encounter with the grace and forgiveness of God. But John Zoll then said, we don't really need to worry about who gets the credit, because wherever, didn't he say, Tolstoy, wherever love is, God is, and we can believe that it is Jesus Christ wherever sinners have a friend. And I have still not been able to find another view of God in the world in which sinners have a friend. Remember, and this is my last point, go back and read Carl Hull's book, The Distinctive Element in Christianity. Is it out on the thing?
We just sold out.
Just sold out. The distinctive. Oh, and read Jack Kerouac's Big Sur. Get Jack. Oh, are you out of your mind? It is the Christian masterpiece of. You won't believe the last 20 pages of Big Sur by Jack Kerouac. But Hall said, the one thing that Christianity and Christ offers that no religion does is he engages with sinners without having first to make them righteous. And Hall says that that, in terms of the Religionsgeschichte Schule, the school of religious comparative religion, no one had ever found a religion that allows a sinner to be a sinner for love to fall. And that is the unique gift of Jesus, in my personal opinion. Thank you for listening, and go home and have fun.